All right, if you'll take your Bibles and turn in them to 1 Chronicles, 1 Chronicles chapter 16. 1 Chronicles chapter 16. I hope that what I say tonight makes sense. I'm just not too sure it will. It's just something about sitting in a car and driving for a long time that makes your brain fried, trying to keep track of six kids, you know, in a lot of different, somewhere a long way away from here, make sure that they're adequately supplied with materials. We had a great day today. But now we got to do this. All right, 1 Chronicles, chapter 16, verse 29. Tonight, well, before you're there, let me just bring us to those passages. A couple Sundays ago, we had a guest speaker, Pastor Weiss, I think his name was, and he preached on praise or worship. And I think it's really, really clear that he wanted us to see that praise and worship are two different things. Worship is not praise. Praise is not worship. I think that for sure he was trying to let us know, because I want to develop that thought, that worship is not praise. Worship is submission, right? So when we're worshiping, if we're truly worshiping God, we're submitted to God in when we worship. Now, Romans 12:1 says, I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable unto God, which is your reasonable service. And we would really understand that, right, to say that all of us, every part of our being, should be submitted to God, right? So everything, every part of us, everything that we do should be done in submission to God. And so, with that thought in mind, really, everything, all of life, is worship. Okay, so worship isn't praise, but praise ought to be worship. In fact, everything that we do should be worship. Singing should be worship. Preaching should be worship. Teaching should be worship. Washing the dishes should be worship. Yeah, Gideon, you got that? Right? Really, all of life is worship. And just as a, I hope I don't go on, I don't know, anyway. When this understanding re-hit civilization, it was around middle of the 1500s, and when many people in the world understood that everything in their life was worship, they looked at everything they did in a different way. And that's why that's the beginning of our modern civilization came out of people understanding that whatever they were doing it in submission to God and for God, even if they were helping their other mankind around them. Anyway, so all of life is worship, and I want to tonight to just talk a little bit, try to make some sense to you about how we should worship. We know that worship is submission. But how should we worship? And particularly, I want to talk about some basics of worship style. The style of worship. When we worship, what style is allowable, or what style should we use when we worship? This lesson kind of is a bridge also between a month of trying to be emphasize distinct music, and next month, distinct worship. How should we worship? Music is part of our worship services here. But there's a lot of things that are a part of this worship. We're all together in this room. And we have a wooden pulpit, not a plexiglass pulpit. I'm front and center, not off to the side. There's a lot of the arrangement of what we're doing here is in some sense on purpose. Some of it is just because the way it's been done, but there's a reason it's been done that way. Let's just go into this. I would like to, some of the things that I say will maybe clearly be applied to music. I may use music as an illustration. But first, I want us to understand properly how we should think about style and then also worship style in particular. So what is style? Now, I'm the philosopher, right? I don't know if I'm a philosopher, but I like to read about philosophy and stuff like that. And when we study philosophy, we, the big word is metaphysics, but metaphysics talks about what is real. You know, what is real? Is this real? Is the idea real, or is the, you know, what is reality? How did we come to be? What is being? Also in philosophy, we talk about what is true. What is truth? How do we know that what we know? How do we know if what we know is true? Okay, so truth, reality, philosophers talk about what is good or right. That would be ethics. What's the right thing to do and the wrong thing to do? And philosophers talk about aesthetics, which is beauty. So there's reality, truth, goodness, and beauty. Style would belong with beauty. Style isn't really, style belongs as a subset of beauty. So we're thinking about style, and style is a part of beauty. So many people, that maybe people that you know, maybe family members in at another church or friends, even people that used to come here and are now somewhere else might say, well, they are choosing a certain style, but they believe that the style that they choose is neutral. That it doesn't really matter how we go about doing something as long as we're doing the right thing. That how the style doesn't really matter. And I don't believe that, and I think that we should understand that that is not true. First of all, let's think about, as we're thinking about these things, let's talk about this subjective versus objective. And I'm using academic words, but it's Thursday night. Okay, so hopefully I get the definitions right because my brain is a little fried. But subjective versus objective. The idea of subjective is that it's personal. Something that's subjective is my dreams, my opinions, my hopes, likes, dislikes. This is what I like. That means it's subjective. So if I say something and you say to me, or you say something, you're out at work and you say something that you believe is true, and somebody says, well, that's your truth. What are they saying? They're saying that is something that's not objectively true. It's true to you, but it's not. And if they're saying that to you, they're saying, that's not true for me. Now, it might be subjectively true. Depends on what you said, doesn't it? If I said, I drove to Grand Rapids today, you'd say, that's true for you, but not for me. That was a subjective truth, right? But if I said Grand Rapids is in Michigan, you can't say, well, maybe for you, but not for me. Okay, do you understand? There are some things that are subjectively true. There are other things that are not subjectively true. There are objective truths. Now, the world, especially today, tries to believe, wants to believe, insists on believing that there's no objective truth. They would laugh with us when I'd say, well, Grand Rapids might be in Michigan to you, but not to me. They'd have to explain that away somehow. But if I said, Jesus is God, they would say, well, maybe for you, but not for me. Okay? So while I admit that there are some subjective truths, there are also things that are not subjectively true. They are true before I ever came along. They were true before any of us came along. They've always been true. So whether something is subjective or not depends on what it is, whether it's objective or subjective. Objective truth refers to things that are the way they are and were the way they were without regard for me, whether I like it or dislike it. Like the facts of nature, the laws of logic, truth from the Bible, morality, the colors of the rainbow, these things rightly belong as objective things, that it doesn't matter what I think about them, whether they're true or not. So we believe, we understand, or we should understand, that truth, goodness, reality, beauty are objective, not subjective. In God's world, and that's where we are, He created it, we have objective truth. We have truth that doesn't depend on my mind. Even if I can't comprehend it, that doesn't mean it's not true. If I never heard of it before, it doesn't mean it's not true. It's always been true. It doesn't depend on anyone for its existence. It's true. We have objective goodness. That means standards of right and wrong. There are some things that are right. There are some things that are wrong. That goes beyond, that transcends my personal preferences, whether I want to do it or not, whether I like it or not. I've read about them. Obviously, I came here to school, so I never experienced this, but you hear about these, you know, moral dilemmas that like word problems. There's been a shipwreck. There's only five of us left. We're in a life raft, but there's only food for three people. There's a, you know, whatever. There's an 85-year-old. There's a Down syndrome person. You know, all these, like, and who should live? All of them. Because thou shalt not kill. It's a law. It transcends all situations. Okay? Abortion. We're coming to deliver a child, and we can save the mother's life if we kill this baby. We don't kill. We try to save both lives. You don't kill. Why? Because there's right and wrong. There is objective right and wrong. And we have objective beauty. Beauty that is beautiful without any regard for the eye of the beholder. Right? How many of us have said, beauty is in the eye of the beholder? So in a certain sense, there is a subjective element to these things, but we must believe that there is objective beauty. Some things were beautiful before I ever saw them. Some things are majestic before I ever saw them. There's some things that are majestic that I've never seen. It's still majestic. It's still beautiful. There are objective standards of beauty. Again, it doesn't eliminate the idea that we are people and we're fallen. And there are subjective elements of this. But my tastes and opinions are mine, not someone else's. My subjective hopes and wishes and desires do have an objective meaning. Okay, so let's say I'm thirsty and I'm, I don't know, let's say I'm over there in the Red Fox Cafe and I'm sitting there talking to, who should I pick on? I'm talking to Dean. Me and Dean are over there. We're sitting down and I say, man, I am thirsty for a root beer. I would just love to have a root beer right now. Now, those are my feelings and my desires. But they're expressed in terms of objective truth. Thirst always means the same thing. Now, Dean might not be thirsty, but I'm thirsty. So in a subjective sense, I'm thirsty. But we all know what thirst is, right? If Dean says, let me take care of that for you, and he goes to the counter, he buys something and brings me back some chicken tenders. Okay, we all know what a root beer is, right? Well, he says, well, this is root beer to me. Okay, so understand, there is subjective, but what we say in a subjective sense is relative to an objective, even though we have subjective feelings and desires. So it's all in relationship to something that isn't relative. So let's think about something that's right and wrong, good and bad, right and wrong. Any one of you that have a house and you have children can fill in the house rule that fits here. Okay? Let's say, but it's a good example of subjective goodness. Let's say in my house, no one is allowed to jump over the couch. Okay? You can run all around, but there's no jumping over the couch. Now, anywhere else, is it a sin to jump over the couch? Does the Bible say thou shalt not jump over the couch? No. So jumping over the couch is not an objective standard. But in my house, or in our house, mom's rule is the law. And if the kids jump over the couch, have they violated the Bible? Yes. Because in relationship connected to jumping over the couch is mom who says thou shalt not jump over the couch. So the Bible does say, obey your parents, right? It doesn't say, don't jump over the couch. So we can see there's a subjective element to that, but it's connected to unchanging goodness or right and wrong. And the same can be said for beauty. So we have truth, right and wrong, goodness and beauty. Now, the insistence in saying that there must be objective beauty, objective standard of beauty, doesn't eliminate personal taste. Some things are beautiful to some people and that are not beautiful to other people. Some people really think that a chihuahua is desirable. Some chihuahuas think people's ankles are desirable. You know, it's a matter of personal taste. But what I'm trying to say is that truth, goodness, beauty cannot be fully understood in subjective terms. The subjective finds its meaning in the objective. And truth, goodness, and beauty have objective meaning in the absolute personality of God. God is truth. Right? He's truth. And his word proclaims that truth. So we have the truth. God is truth. God is holy and just and good. And his law tells us what is holy and just and good. And God, the Bible tells us, God is altogether lovely. And so his creation shows us, reveals his loveliness. So those are ultimately objective standards of truth, goodness, and beauty. Now, as we think about worship then, so that's understanding style a little bit, or beauty a little bit. As we think about style or worship style, it must be what we think about, the way that we worship has to be rooted in the fact that there are objective standards of beauty And so then there are objective standards of style. Everyone has their own style they like, but what they like for them is in some relationship to what is beautiful or good in style. If this is not true, if what we believe about style and how we do things isn't connected to some objective standard, then there is no standard that it's connected to. We can use any style we want. Okay? Either there is a standard that we need to be connected to, or there's not. There's an objective standard. So if there's not, then how should we determine what style we should have? Now I'm thinking about a church, worship style. If I don't have an objective standard to connect my style choices to, I might choose a pragmatic standard. What works the best? Well, and that's going to be connected to what I think I'm going to try to accomplish. Now, I could have a good goal and try to accomplish it in a bad way if I don't have an objective standard. I might say, I want to reach as many people as possible. And reaching as many people as possible means we get as many people filling the pews here. If we get them in, that's the goal. We want to reach them. And if I don't have any standard on style, worship style, then let's just do whatever we can to get as many people in the doors as possible. So, and I don't think I'm mischaracterizing this. I'm creating a dichotomy. We have either one or the other, but I believe this is, at least by looking at this landscape of Christianity today, that's where we are. If there's a third choice, I haven't seen it. I haven't heard about it. Either people are trying to hold a standard of objective, beautiful style in worship, or they're not. They're totally abandoning that and saying, let's just use whatever style will work for this noble goal that we have. So, I've refined my place there. So then what happens, just to summarize that idea, is that pragmatism becomes ultimate. Now, I think I say this later, but we're not saying that pragmatism doesn't, you know, practical choices don't have any bearing. We need to have carpet, or we want to have carpet, and we want the carpet to last a long time, so let's pragmatically choose a long-lasting carpet. We want the pews to last a long time. You know, we make practical, pragmatic choices, but pragmatism, practicality, is not the rule. It's in subjection to the standard, to the objective standard. So, So how should we worship? We're getting there. I see this reference here. Let's just go ahead and read it now. We're commanded to worship the Lord in the beauty of holiness. Look at 1 Chronicles 16:29. You probably closed your Bible, but if you still got it there or had your finger there, 1 Chronicles 16:29. Give unto the Lord the glory due unto his name. Bring an offering and come before him. Worship the Lord in the beauty of holiness. Psalm 29:2 says, give unto the Lord the glory due unto his name. Worship the Lord in the beauty of holiness. Psalm 96:9. O worship the Lord in the beauty of holiness. Fear before him all the earth. So, we should see there, and I did a quick survey of the Bible. When the Bible talks about worship, almost all the time that the Bible talks about worship, it falls under the idea that Pastor Weiss brought to us. But there are these times, all the other times don't talk about how to worship, but there are these times that tell us how. We worship the Lord how? In the beauty of holiness. Now, a lot of people, and it goes against my flesh, I must admit. Also, all of us are like, there's a standard for beauty? You mean if that person thinks it's beautiful, I have to think it's beautiful too? No. He's a person, you're a person, okay? But we must admit, we cannot just say, well, because he thinks something's beautiful and I don't think it's beautiful and he thinks something's beautiful and I don't think that's beautiful either. We cannot become the rule of what is beautiful. Just because we can't, we are fallen creatures and we may not be able to wrap our mind around it, we must accept, and that's part of worship, we must submit ourselves to God that he has a standard of beauty, because he says here we're to worship in the beauty of holiness. Now, I don't know what that means fully, but when you put beauty and holiness together, I know God knows what that means. Even if I don't know what it means fully, God knows what that means. And so, as much as possible, it's my responsibility to match what God thinks that is. And when I say think, I don't mean like he's wondering. He knows what God says that is. So, and then there's one other verse, and it doesn't use the word worship, but I think it's uses the idea. Hebrews 12:28 says, "Wherefore, we receiving a kingdom which cannot be moved, let us have grace, whereby we may serve God," and worship is submission, "we may serve God acceptably," how? "Acceptably, with reverence and godly fear." Now, I'm kind of jumping ahead of myself, but we would just conclude from those verses that worship should be reverent, in godly fear, beautiful, and holy. Would be some summaries of that. So, I kind of said this a little bit, but if we don't have an objective standard, beauty loses all meaning. Right? So if I said it's kind of hard for me to accept this, if Pastor Armacost thinks something's beautiful and Mr. Ramis thinks something else, if we all are like, well, there's all these differences, and if there's no standard, that means all of us are right, none of us are right, and what does that mean? It doesn't matter. Right? If everybody's right and there's no standard, then it doesn't even have any meaning. It doesn't matter what's right or wrong. And that would mean the same thing with how we worship. Of course, how we worship does have meaning. God commands us to worship him in the beauty of holiness. So whatever that means, that's what we should be doing. And there is a meaning for that. And God knows exactly what he meant by that, and we can know what is beautiful and good and beauty by examining the things that God says are beautiful. So, somebody might say, well, yes, but style choices are really just a preference. What I say is what is the truth is what really matters. And you might say, well, for sure, the truth matters. But let's just take a mundane example. Imagine Tony Wright announcing the results of today's Cubs game. What was the result, Tony? Tore them up. What was it? 10-2 or more? 12-2. Okay, so just imagine Tony Wright announcing that. Now, imagine Bill Ramis announcing that. Yeah. Imagine Yura Shrock announcing that. Steve Brady. Okay. What the facts are still true. But what's the message? There's a different message with each person, right? The message might be excitement. It might be disappointment. It might be contempt. All with the same truth, right? In the way that they say something, with the style that they choose to say it. Now, I'm forcing that word on there, but in how they say something says something more than just the facts. So when I stand up here, if I dress a certain way and use certain vocabulary to announce something that's true, I might be conveying a different idea than if I dressed a different way and used different vocabulary, right? The message is not just the words. Style is not neutral. Our perspective of beauty gives us the sense that it is subjective, because our view of it makes us think that it's subjective. But that does not mean that it is in itself. It does not only exist in the eye of the beholder. That idea comes from our humanity. We come from a fallen human perspective and a limited human perspective and a finite human perspective. But that does not mean that it is subjective. So our style says something. The way Tony says the Cubs won, and the way Bill says the Cubs won, and the way my wife says the Cubs won, it says the truth is the same, but the message says something else. And so the style we choose for worship, we could be using the same King James Bible. We could be saying the same words from a song, but the style that we choose to participate together in that, whether it is the clothing style that I choose, the musical style that I choose, the lighting style. You know, if this looked like a stage, it would mean it was all about this up here rather than all about us here, and all about us worshiping God. There's all of this. The style expresses something about God. We might be saying truth about God, but how we say it expresses what we think about God. Expresses just as much as the doctrines that we hold while we worship. And so the way that we choose to worship God together should not be disconnected from what we say we believe about God. We can say, oh, God is an almighty, awesome God. Okay, I could say God is an awesome God, or I could say God is awesome, dude. One is, that's sacrilegious, used as an illustration. Okay, I could be all cool about God, and what does that tell people? God is cool. God is not cool. And he's not cool with that. Right? So, there shouldn't be, if we say who we believe, if we say we believe what the Bible says about God, the way we worship and the way we work together to worship God, to show our submission to him, should reveal that, should say those same things. Now, let's think together, and I've kind of already said it, but what are some elements of corporate worship? Now, this is a class, but I'm way up here. Let's get some, what are elements of corporate worship? Corporate is meaning what we're doing right here. We're all together, not private, not at home, sitting on my chair, not at the kitchen table with my family. Here at church, this is corporate worship. What are elements of corporate worship? Volunteer. What's that? Giving. Giving. Kevin. Prayer. Praying. Singing. Anyone else? Preaching. Thank you. Preaching. But does everybody preach? No. So what else? Listening. Hearing. How about what we do before church? What about what we do after church? What about what we did last Sunday night at church? Communion. Okay, so there's, I think, and there could be more, but those are the things that I had quickly thought of. Those are all things that we do together, and those are all things that we worship God through here together. How do we do those things? The style that we use to do that. Okay? You may have come from a church or been in a church where when you walk in, there's not lively music going on. There's very calm music. People go right to their seat and they sit there and they read the Bible and pray. They've chosen that as a form of how they get to prepare for their service. Now, that's not what we've chosen to do. But how many of you have caught a little kid, a little four-year-old, or I guess they're older than, you know, 4 or 5-year-old, they're doing laps around the auditorium before church. And you say, hey, I'm glad you're having a good time, but we're getting ready for church. Don't be running up and down the aisles. Do you say that? You ought to say that, right? Because what we're doing before we start church is preparing us for worship. And how we communicate before church is part of what we do together. So, anyway, God is the standard of beauty. He himself is altogether lovely. He's fairer than the fairest, and all ultimate loveliness and beauty rest in him. The Bible says of him, thou art fairer than the children of men. Grace is poured into thy lips. Therefore, God has blessed thee forever. One thing have I desired of the Lord, that will I seek after, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to behold the beauty of the Lord, and to inquire at his temple. Psalm 97, and let the beauty of the Lord our God be upon us, and establish thou the work of our hands upon us. Yea, the work of our hands establish thou it. God is the source and the fount of all that is beautiful. He makes everything beautiful in his time. He's created a world that is full of beautiful works of art. And God requires from us two things in worship: reverence and godly fear, which we read about in Hebrews, and the beauty of holiness. And God knows what he means by these, reverence and godly fear and the beauty of holiness, but he hasn't really hidden it from us. I agree it's easier for it to be obfuscated, or whatever that word is, because of our human subjective nature. But he has an objective standard for reverence, fear, beauty, and holiness, and he requires us to meet that standard in how we come to him, how we worship him, especially together. One thing for sure, it says reverence, godly fear, the beauty of holiness. There's nothing in there about relevance. There's nothing there. Relevance meaning there's nothing in the Bible about when we worship about it being acceptable to people, especially to people who are not God's children. So when we come together, we're not concerned about the lost in that sense. We're not trying to, when we worship God, we're not saying, well, we hope these unsaved people will enjoy. When we want God to enjoy when we worship him. God is the audience. God is the one that we want to, our worship isn't relative to the world because it must be relevant to God, and who is unchanging and unchangeable. And it's a wicked thing then to take what belongs to God and prostitute it to the world, to somehow seek to be attractive to the world with it. We, God's church, are his bride. We shouldn't be making ourselves attractive to the world. We should be making ourselves attractive to Jesus. Our beauty is for God and not the world. And so we believe that our style should seek to imitate and reflect the beauty of God as we see it in his created world. First, the choices must be made from a heart that is in submission to God. And whether it's whatever we choose, how we choose to decorate the auditorium, how we choose to arrange the auditorium, the music, the style of music, the way we choose to accompany the music, whether we use drums or not use drums. Sometimes we use drums, sometimes we don't use drums, or anything else. Sometimes we don't use instruments. We just use the instrument that God gave us right inside our voice, right inside of our head. That's an instrument. We use all different, but what we, our choices there have to be made from a heart that is submissive to God, and it must display our reverence for the beauty of God. Worship is not me serving God my way. It is me, or it's not us serving God our way, or me serving God my way. It is us, or me, giving God what he wants. We're giving God what he wants. So some believe that God has no preference. God doesn't care as long as we, you know, as long as we feel good about it. But has God not said anything that he wants? The style of music that we use in worship is just as much a part of the worship as what we're doing in worship. The clothing we wear. So that from the time that you walk in here, or the time that a guest of yours walks in here, we are saying something to that guest, let's say, about how we view God. And it also, it shapes our view of God, is what I said. And that is because it has an objective meaning. We develop our view of God from the style of worship that we participate in. If we grew up, some of you may have, if you grew up in a very formal, what we would call high church kind of church services, formalistic, very stiff. If you grew up in that, you might have grown up thinking that God is very distant, and he is harsh, and he's far away. You can't do anything. You know, he is there, and I'm here, and that's it. Maybe he's very unfriendly. He's angry all day long. If you grew up in a charismatic type of church and that type of worship style, you might think of God as a power supply. You know, you just go to him when you need something. And there's many varieties in between those and beyond. But the way we worship frames what we think of God. It affects and changes what we think of God. And so we as a church would want our worship to form in our own minds, because it is forming that, and in our children's minds, the proper view of God. What do we think God is like from the scriptures? Then we want our worship to reflect that, because our worship is teaching us what God is like. Just like songs that we sing teach us theology, many of us, we couldn't pass a systematic theology test, but we know certain things that are true because we sing about them all the time. And it's much the same with what we think about God is very much affected by how we come together and worship God. All right, I'm going to try to wrap this up. The second commandment, thou shalt not make unto me any graven image, helps us a little bit understand this. So God said, you need to, the first commandment, thou shalt have no other gods before me. I'm the only God. And then he says, and don't try to make an image of me. Don't try to add to what I am. There's nothing you can do to add to what I am. That would be one way to say it. Don't make a graven image. Paul addressed this idea in Acts 17. He said God isn't worshipped with men's hands as though he needed anything. And so that idea is that we cannot add anything to God when we worship. Nothing we do adds to God. God is majestic, he is glorious, he is beautiful. Anything that we do doesn't add to him. And so we shouldn't try to use human means to I don't think I'm being clear here. But anyway, so you might say, and now that's going to be a rabbit trail, but you might say, so then why do we even sing? Why do we use any instruments? We shouldn't add anything to that. Some people believe that. Some people say we should only sing the Psalms. Don't, because those are the only things written by God. The rest, you know, songs, those were written by men. We're adding to what we're given in the Bible. Well, we don't have time to discuss that, but the tunes that those songs are sung to are made by men. So there's a fallacy in that argument. But the idea is that we don't worship God our way. I would say we don't worship God our way. We have to worship God his way. And he said, no idols, or he says something else. The point is that worship shapes our expectations and desires in worship. And cultural relevance, being relevant to the world around us, should not be a consideration when we approach worship. We should limit our consideration. We should limit our choices to what God wants and not what speaks to our culture or appeals to it. We shouldn't be concerned about... We ought to be concerned about the lost, but when we come together to worship God, we shouldn't be concerned about whether it appeals to them. If we're concerned about whether it pleases God, that's going to be enough. I mean, if we could care less what we sound like, if the ladies who came up here never practiced, didn't care whether they sang the right notes or not, that would be an offense to God. And it would also be offensive to you, and it would be offensive to, you know, somebody from the world comes and says, well, those guys are hokey-dokey, whatever. Okay? But, so if we just take care of pleasing God, we're going to be not an offense to people that want to worship God. And that's where it needs to stop. We shouldn't really be concerned about whether somebody coming in from is going to enjoy that dead, you know, that doesn't have the beat that they want to hear or something like that. So, so we acknowledge that there's objective standards of beauty, and it's our duty to uphold that standard in everything. That applies to beauty, and there are practical considerations that must be made, but we reject any form of pragmatism which elevates itself to the ultimate authority. If it's just because it works, we reject that. What clothing is available to us, what directions are... decoration are appropriate, that's fine. But we arrange what we do according to purpose, and our purpose is to please and worship God. Our style should be distinctly Christian, and thus it should be distinct from the world. The Bible tells us over and over again that there's you know, the world and the Christian do not get together. So we should be distinctly, right, distinct from the world. Our worship should be distinct from the world. Our music should be distinct from the world. We must make a difference between the holy and the profane. So our rule about style would be transcendent. God is transcendent. The world is trendy. One week it likes something, the next week it doesn't. We don't follow trends. We want to be transcendent. And we want to make our style choices. But we don't disregard what is in the culture around us, but we don't let the culture dictate to us what we should have. Every culture has standards for casual and formal, and our purpose is to reverence God. So we look at beauty and reverence. Our culture, different cultures are going to have different standards of what reverence is. But we don't adopt, we're not a multicultural place. We're in America. Americans have standards of how you show reverence to something. And we ought to show the same type of reverence when we come to God's, to worship God. I know, I've seen pictures of people visiting the president and, some college sports team and the kids have flip-flops on. Okay? But we all know that that's not showing reverence, right? Okay? Because our culture has a standard of what's reverent. Whether somebody does it or not doesn't mean that the standard has changed. We have a standard. So we don't wear flip-flops to church. Or people that do don't understand how irreverent they are, or they're purposely being irreverent. And that's just using flip-flops. But the principle applies for us. We're to worship God in reverence and godly fear and in the beauty of holiness. And so these principles and these ideas should help us understand what we're trying to accomplish when we come together to worship God and all the different things that we do when we worship God together. And they naturally would apply to when we worship God ourselves, personally, and in our homes also.